How are variants changing the conversation around COVID? From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Monday, April 19th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Secretary Kim Mulsom-Risden joins us on behalf of the State Department of Health. We'll talk about South Dakota's vaccine rollout and how to make nuanced decisions about lining up for your shot. We talk about innovations in infertility treatment. We get to know a World War II veteran who celebrated 101 years of living after barely surviving war. Plus, we invite you to share your stories about guns in South Dakota. We'll show you how. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is next.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear oral arguments today in a case that will determine who is eligible for more than $530 million in federal virus relief funding set aside for tribes last year. More than a dozen Native American tribes sued the U.S. Treasury Department to limit the funding to tribes that have a political relationship with the U.S. The Treasury Department says corporations that provide services to Alaska Natives should be eligible too. The case could have broader impacts on who qualifies as a tribe for federal contracting and compacts. Officials overseeing the Missouri River Basin say drought conditions and dry soil are reducing the potential for floods. Hydrologist Kevin Lau expects below-average water flows for the next 3 months.
Flood risk over most of the Missouri Basin is much reduced from normal due to the lack of plain snow, a near-average mountain snowpack, and the extreme soil dryness that exists over most of the basin.
Lau says despite a lower risk for flooding, there's a chance for minor to moderate flooding south of Gavin's Point Dam. Over the last 90 days, South Dakota was warmer than average and saw less precipitation, especially in the north. The National Weather Service predicts above-average temperatures for the entire basin during the summer. As we're seeing the impacts of COVID-19, one of the hardest hits is the price of fuel. As SDPB's Jordan Henderson reports, gas prices will continue to increase with more demand.
A year ago, gas prices were about $1.77 per gallon. There was even a point during the pandemic where the prices dropped below $1 a gallon. Today, prices across the country on average sit at about $2.85 per gallon. Now that communities are opening around the country, people like Sioux Falls resident Elizabeth Huckins miss the gas prices from those times.
Now that everybody's starting to travel more and more, notice them going up. So yeah, I do miss the lower gas prices, definitely.
Huckins drives to Brookings to coach and believes the increase in her fuel costs are brutal.
I'm hoping they'll go back down. I know it's probably going to keep going up throughout the summer, you know, when people are traveling a lot more. But yeah, I'm hoping they'll decline once winter hits again.
Prices have increased 60 cents since the start of the new year. And for Tim Taylor, that price is still too low.
I still think they're too low.
You still think they're too low?
Way too low.
And why?
Gas pollutes. It's causing the ozone layer to dissolve. We're paying nothing to get around. We're driving probably more than we should. We got way too much gas right now because people didn't use it. And there's no way electricity is ever going to come to the forefront like President Biden wants it to unless we jack up the gas prices. So bring them.
Taylor drives 60 miles to and from work every day with what he describes as
some pretty thirsty vehicles.
Taylor believes the age of electric cars is coming. But until then, he's going to enjoy the lower prices.
Hey, I'm enjoying the low prices with everybody else. But for the sustainability of the earth and the betterment of the air we breathe and probably for our future generations, bring on the high prices.
With summer approaching and many people making travel plans, gas prices are expected to rise with demand. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jordan Henderson.
For weather today, we're seeing cloudy skies in the west and southeast, with scattered snow showers in the west. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Kelly Sayre is Warning Coordination Meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Aberdeen, and she's joining us today to talk about Severe Weather Awareness Week in South Dakota. Kelly Sayre, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It is that time of year again, so tell us a little bit about some of the goals of the National Weather Service this week in getting people to start, once again, thinking about spring, summer weather and severe weather in South Dakota.
Yeah, it might be hard right now, especially if you live out in far southwest South Dakota, where you're still under winter weather headlines, advisories, and are expecting some snow. But the idea of Awareness Week, which it runs Monday through Friday this week, is to get people thinking about their response to severe weather in the summertime, if they're prepared, if they're ready, what they would do and where they would go if severe weather was about to strike their area.
Yeah, it's like ordering seeds for your garden. It's okay to, start early and think ahead. Tell us a few of the things about what has changed about how we get notifications of severe weather, because now I think for a lot of us, they come to our phone with flash flood warnings and things like that.
Yeah, we recommend that people have multiple reliable sources of getting information because they can all fail in one way or the other. So you always want to have at least one backup to your primary method. And there are lots of ways to get alerts in the summertime. Radio stations, TV stations, there are good reliable cell phone apps out there. Weather radio is still a good reliable source as well because it has battery backup. So if the electricity goes out and you can't turn on your TV or your cell phone battery goes dead and you can't charge it, you still have another way of getting that information. The newest one of all of those is what we call the Wireless Emergency Alerts. And it's a collaboration between the FCC and the Weather Service, and FEMA is involved as well. And they basically have said there are certain things that cell phones should just automatically alert to. So if your cell phone is a newer model, really most models are pretty much compatible these days, it comes with this alerting feature enabled and on in your phone. And so for tornado warnings or flash flood warnings that we have tagged as considerable or catastrophic, it will automatically alert people's cell phones who are in that area. And it'll look like a little text message, but the sound you get is a little bit different, and it'll say click for more information, and then you can click and quickly find out what's going on for your area. Down the road, they are planning on adding severe thunderstorm warnings for hail and wind, and we think that's still going to happen this year, but it's not in place yet. So look for that information as it comes out sometime in the near future.
So when I was growing up, I just called this dad, and he was the one who always called me and told me if there was ice on the road or if there was severe weather coming. But let's go over some basics for those young adults, because I really remember that time of trying to like start paying attention to some things for the first time. Tell us the difference between things like watches and warnings for people who maybe haven't paid attention to that before.
Absolutely. Watches and warnings get confused all the time because they kind of sound alike. Watch, warning, you know, WA. And so it's good to think about them and remember the difference. Watch means conditions are favorable for severe weather to occur. So we probably don't have storms yet at this time frame, but we've looked at all the weather data and all the ingredients are there for the storms to develop. It just hasn't happened yet. And this is the perfect opportunity to plan, to prepare, to look at, you know, do you have some evening activities planned? And if these storms might pop up, what would you do then? Can you change or modify your events? And then the warning means it's actually occurring. We are seeing it on radar, or we're getting reports from the field saying we have severe weather out of this storm and anybody who is in that area needs to shelter now.
And let's talk about sheltering, because you might be at work, you might be at home. A lot of people have changed jobs during the pandemic and are coming back to a different office than where they were working before. What do you need to look for as far as planning and thinking about the place that you will shelter in the event of severe weather?
Yes, basements are always best when it comes to severe weather. If you have a basement, that's where you're going to want to go. Even in basements, it's good to kind of protect yourself in the event of some falling debris. If you can have a strong, sturdy workbench or something to get under. You also want to be away from windows. Sometimes basements also have windows. If you don't have a basement, it's the main floor. It's the most interior room on the main floor of your house or building. And this room isn't going to have windows. So sometimes it's a bathroom, sometimes it's a closet, but it's in the middle of the building and it doesn't have windows. There's really no safe place outdoors. You really got to try as much as you can to get into a strong, sturdy building and away from windows.
Kelly Sayre is warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service. It is Severe Weather Awareness Week, so you'll be hearing things and tune into them and pay attention all week long. Get yourself ready. You will not regret that. Kelly Sayre, we'll leave people with the time that I was in the middle of a severe weather storm and decided that I just had to go pick up my daughter. And that was a bad idea because she was perfectly well sheltered. And even though it all ended up safe, I ruined my car by driving into a hailstorm. So your kids are safe at the camp that they're at. The counselors will take care of them. Stay home and don't try to race a storm. Kelly Sayre, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Ahead on In the Moment, we're going to talk about infertility treatment and innovations in that as we look at a month of awareness for people trying to conceive. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
In 2020, Russian hackers penetrated some of America's most sensitive computer systems and were roaming around in them, reading emails, perhaps stealing, or even changing things.
They were able to get access to some very sensitive companies and government organizations without getting caught for quite a while.
What the Russians did to hack SolarWinds and how America is responding this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. Before First Dakota filed its charter in 1872, there wasn't a bank in South Dakota. What will be your South Dakota first? FirstDakota.com/first.
I'm Jackie Hendry, host of South Dakota Focus. A recent USDA Forest Service report calls for decreased timber production in the Black Hills, and one sawmill has already closed. U.S. Congressman Dusty Johnson weighs in. Dr. David O'Hara shows how environmental studies students are changing the landscape of Augustana University. Plus, the next installment of our series, Good Neighbors. That's Thursday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB-TV.
Program funding by the Matthews Opera House and Arts Center in Spearfish. Enjoy the American Patchwork Quartet, April 29th at 7:30 p.m., featuring Grammy-nominated musicians. Ticket information at matthewsoperahouse.com/APQ.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. April is Infertility Awareness Month. Dr. Keith Hansen is a reproductive endocrinologist with Sanford Health, and he's joining us today with a look at the latest innovations in helping people conceive. Dr. Hansen, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak today.
I really want to talk about some of the innovations in infertility treatment, but I think we have to deal with the fact that sometimes when there is an awareness month, it is because people have a hard time talking about these things, because before science existed, there was a lot of shame regarding people who were trying to conceive and couldn't, or miscarriages and lost pregnancies by people who wanted to carry those children to term. What has changed in the field of infertility? How do you see people approaching their conversations with their doctors in different ways than maybe they did historically?
Well, thanks. Yes, you're exactly right. I mean, science and technology have really enhanced our abilities to care for couples who are either having troubles getting pregnant or having trouble staying pregnant, depending on the cause for those two different things. Things that have improved have been improvements in, first of all, diagnosing what the reason for the difficulty conceiving or continuing the pregnancy is, and then enhancements in our abilities to help the couple conceive or help the couple to continue, for the pregnancy to continue, be that either with different hormonal therapies that are available, different surgical techniques that have been enhanced, and then also different ways that we can enhance fertilization and hopefully implantation and growth of a normal embryo.
Can you talk to me about the definition of infertility leading into this idea of if you're trying to conceive, when do you know it's time to include your doctor in the conversation because it has become a struggle in some way?
Well, the definition of infertility is basically when a couple have been trying to conceive for over a year without success. That has been the definition for a long time. We've recently changed the definition a little bit. And now when we have a couple where the female partner is 35 years of age or older, we consider it to be infertility when they've failed to conceive after 6 months of trying. The other definition of infertility is when there's a history that would suggest that there may be trouble conceiving. One example of that is if a young woman is not having menstrual cycles, you know, in other words, she's what we call amenorrhea, or she's not had a single menstrual cycle, or if her cycles are very irregular, then that tells us that she's either not ovulating, in other words, not releasing an egg, or only ovulating once in a while. And so those patients where we have a history such as that suggests a problem, we want to see them right away so we can help them, you know, to start ovulating regularly, to look at other potential factors that may be involved and get them on the path to hopefully successful conception and pregnancy soon.
For people who are thinking about having children or trying to conceive and who have a history of miscarriages or fertility issues in their family, is this genetically related at all? Is there a connection if your mother or your sister or your, you know, brother's wife, any kind of genetic connection?
Well, there are some genetic things that can cause infertility. And there's also genetic things that can cause miscarriages. An example of one of the things that can cause infertility is endometriosis, which is where the lining of the uterus is growing outside of its normal location, and that can cause like scar tissue and also difficulty with fertilization and early development of the baby. And we know that endometriosis can be familial and has an increased incidence in families. Recurrent miscarriages, there are other things that can also be genetic that cause it, such as if there's a chromosomal abnormality like a balanced translocation or a balanced inversion where the person has a one of their chromosomes gets stuck on another one and vice versa, or where a little bit of chromosome flips over, they're normal because they haven't gained or lost any DNA. But when they go to make either sperm in the male's case or an egg in the female's case, it can come out abnormal, which can then result in difficulties continuing a pregnancy. And those can actually be passed down through families.
What are some of the first things that you do as an endocrinologist, as a reproductive endocrinologist, when somebody is referred to you by their family doctor or a patient comes in and says, I don't know what's going on? What are some of the tests and questions that you ask?
Well, the first thing we do is get a good history and physical, try to get as much information as we can from them, you know, to first try to determine what is the cause of their infertility or their recurrent miscarriages, as well as are there any health issues or family issues that might complicate a pregnancy. So some of the questions that we ask are, first of all, how often does the woman have a menstrual cycle? And if a woman has a menstrual cycle every month, and like clockwork, and her periods are heavier and a little more painful, she can tell when she ovulates, then she most likely is ovulating every month unless she's on the birth control pills. The other thing is, if she comes in and says, hey, I get a period once every 3 months, or I get a period once every year, then she most likely is not ovulating at all, or only ovulating once every blue moon. And so in that case, we know that probably the problem is that she has that she's not ovulating. We also look for any suggestion that there might be a problem with her fallopian tubes or with her uterus. So we want to ask, you know, are her periods normal? Are they heavy? Does she get a lot of pain with them? Has she ever had any major abdominal surgeries, a ruptured appendix, tuberculosis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, any sort of thing that could damage the fallopian tubes? And we want to know about that because, of course, if the fallopian tubes aren't working, then there'll be troubles getting pregnant. If there's something wrong with the uterus itself, like if she has a big fibroid jutting into the cavity, that can interfere with a baby being able to implant and grow. We also then want to look at her history and see, does she have any medical problems that could be an issue during the pregnancy or during labor and delivery? We also want to make sure that she's had all of her immunizations. Both her and her husband have got their immunizations up to date because, you know, one of the really sad things is if a person, when they're pregnant or when they have a little baby at home, gets a disease that can be horrendous for the little baby, and it could have been prevented by getting a vaccine, such as influenza. Influenza is terrible. So we want to make sure about that. We also want to make sure that, you know, do either the husband or wife, do they use tobacco? Tobacco is terrible for gametogenesis, either the formation of an egg or the formation of sperm. Tobacco in any way, shape, or form is really, really bad for getting pregnant or staying pregnant. So we really like to try to get couples from getting off of any tobacco products or other agents that might interfere with fertility. And then we do a in-depth family history to try to see, are there any genetic illnesses that could be passed on to a little baby, or are there anything in the family history that might suggest a problem? And then finally, we turn to the guy and make sure, you know, does he have any history that might suggest a problem? And does he have any underlying medical problems that could be passed on to the baby or could be an issue for a pregnancy? And so we really do an in-depth history and physical exam to try to determine what are the most likely reasons that this couple are having problems either getting pregnant or staying pregnant.
Well, April is Infertility Awareness Month, so much to talk about. And just a reminder, it's a lot easier to track things now when you have that cell phone right in your hands for women who are trying to track their cycles. It got a whole lot easier as technology and personal technology advanced. Our guest has been Dr. Keith Hansen. He is a reproductive endocrinologist with Sanford Health. Dr. Hansen, thanks for bringing this conversation to the airwaves for listeners of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Ahead on the program, we're going to stick with a healthcare topic and really talk about COVID and vaccines and how variants in South Dakota have changed that conversation. Secretary for the Department of Health, Kim Malsom-Risden, is with us. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Early on during the pandemic, bassist and singer Nikki Perrott thought of ways to keep her musical spirits up, and one way was to record with some of her favorite musicians. So she picked out a few favorite pop songs from the 1970s for them to play and arranged the tunes into a jazz setting. I'm Carl Gerke, and on the next Jazz Nightly New Music Monday, we'll sample tracks from Nikki Perrott's latest album and other new releases. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
Hi, I'm Julie Overgaard, Executive Director of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. You know, for nearly 100 years, South Dakota Public Broadcasting has provided educational, informational, and entertaining programs. As we look ahead to our second century of service, we look to you. We're building community, one story at a time. SDPB Sound Vision Campaign is a multi-year effort that has expanded South Dakota-centered news, programming, and events. Please consider a gift. SDPB.org/soundvision.
I'm Jackie Hendry, host of South Dakota Focus. A recent USDA Forest Service report calls for decreased timber production in the Black Hills, and one sawmill has already closed. U.S. Congressman Dusty Johnson weighs in. Dr. David O'Hara shows how environmental studies students are changing the landscape of Augustana University. Plus, the next installment of our series, Good Neighbors. That's Thursday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB-TV.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, South Dakota has now vaccinated around 53% of our residents with at least a first dose of a COVID vaccine. But for younger, healthier people, the decision to vaccinate has become more than an act of service for older and more vulnerable people in their lives. Virus variants are changing the COVID conversation. Today, we welcome South Dakota's Secretary for the State Department of Health, Kim Malsom-Risden. Secretary Malsom-Risden, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
Can you start by explaining to people what exactly a variant is and what kinds of variants we are seeing in South Dakota now?
Sure. So variants with viruses just really reflect some part of that original virus genomic code changing by being, infecting a lot of different people and just having that opportunity to mutate, if you will. And so it often involves just one aspect of the genomic code of the entire first virus changing, and then you'll see the variants named after the part of the genomic code that's actually changed. And so folks are probably familiar with the most common one that we're seeing in South Dakota as well as this country is called the UK variant, and that's because it was just first identified in the UK, and it's known as B117. We've got 55 cases of that variant identified here in South Dakota, and that's out of a total of 65 total variants. So there's other variants associated with Brazil, South Africa, and other parts of the country, other parts of the world where they've been first identified.
So it can be alarming when, double mutant and all these things that you see in headlines, mm-hmm. but mutating is what viruses do.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and especially as they have time to circulate. And so, when we talk about things in the here and now in South Dakota, we're really encouraging vaccinations so that, we have a protected population and that we don't give variants or even the first COVID strain people to infect, and that's what's going to help us, really end this pandemic.
Yeah, so the longer it takes us to vaccinate a population and get to that herd immunity, the more opportunity we're giving the virus to go on to its next evolution and make those cases, possibly deadlier, more contagious. Do we understand that correctly?
Yes, that's absolutely the case. And so, again, a protected population is one where the virus just can't find any hosts, and therefore just doesn't have an opportunity to, develop further mutation. Now, what we do know about the UK variant or that B117 is that, in testing so far, it looks like the vaccines that we have are very effective with that particular variant. And so that's good mm-hmm. news. So people that are choosing to become vaccinated today are going to have protection against that variant as well.
The variants, are they stickier? Are they, what do we know about them? Does it seem like they're more contagious? Is it a lower viral load that will make you sick? Are they more deadly? Like, what do we know yeah. about the variants for those people who are in that unprotected population still?
Yeah. Well, we know the UK variant in particular is more infectious. In fact, almost twice as infectious as the regular COVID or the first COVID variation. And so, that's something that's obviously concerning because that means it can really get to people that aren't protected faster. There's also some thought that, that the South African or the Brazil variant may be more deadly, but they're still really doing some studies on that. So what we know today is the UK variant is more infectious than the first COVID-19 virus.
Let's talk about how we are doing as far as vaccine administration and distribution and vaccine hesitancy. As you see the campaign rollout, and we've talked a lot about how successful it is, but are you seeing, as you break down those numbers, pockets of people, whether it's based on gender or county of residence or age, what are you learning about who is saying yes to the vaccine and who is a little slower to stand in line?
Well, you know, we have had a great, rollout of the vaccine program here in South Dakota. Certainly, we have seen extraordinary uptake among older people, and that's really important because we know COVID can be, you know, very dangerous for older individuals. And so we've seen, anywhere from 75 to 85% of people age 65 and above get the vaccine based on five-year age ranges. So great uptake there. Now that we've got vaccine available for all people age 16 and older, we really want to see younger people become vaccinated. And so, where we're seeing cases of COVID still being tested and confirmed are in that 20 to 29-year-old age range in particular. So in the past 6 weeks alone, they've had a 7% jump in cases. And so, we know we've got younger people to get to so that they can be protected. And again, we can really squelch COVID from circulating in our state. And what that does is then it doesn't spread to people who can become very ill. And that happens, even at starting at age 20. We've had deaths in that age group from 20 to 29. And so while we know COVID is more serious and more deadly for older people, we also know that younger people are not exempt from that.
So what I'm hearing from some of the younger people or, the 30 to 40-year-old professionals who are working and have really been working in some measure throughout the entire pandemic as we've stayed open for business, they're saying to me, well, I've made it this far. I've had exposures and ended up, I've had a couple negative COVID tests and I'm young, I'm healthy. The hospital capacity has plenty of room. So I think I can just go forward without getting this vaccine. And you would say to them, not so fast, think about this. How would you answer some of those people who are really thinking fairly intelligently up to this point about where some of the things to worry about were? Has that changed? What would you say to them?
Well, we really want people to think about vaccination in terms of doing it for themselves so that they themselves are not going to get sick. Because again, when people have COVID, they oftentimes, just don't feel well, and some do end up in the hospital across all age groups. And then we've seen deaths in the age group 20 years of age and up. So do it for themselves, but also do it for their friends and loved ones, because again, we might not know that people that we work with or come into contact with every single day, have vulnerable health conditions that, could really lead to poorer outcomes if they were to contract COVID and they themselves weren't vaccinated. So, it's really something that, what we want to see across the state, our goal is to see at least 70% of people that are eligible for vaccination to be vaccinated, because that's going to give us, a level of protection that, will really slow and even stop the spread of COVID in our state.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. My guest is the Secretary for the State Department of Health, Kim Malsom-Risden. And Secretary, the last time you and I talked, going back to what we said about the success of the rollout, South Dakota was using its full allotment of vaccines every single week that those vaccines were coming in the early days. How are we doing now with using up the supply that we have now that we've made it through some of the, early people who are eligible and that supply has continued to increase?
Well, what's really changed is the landscape of access points for vaccination. And so it's really great to see that there are just many, many opportunities for people to become vaccinated. Community pharmacies across the state have vaccine available. Of course, our health systems continue to have vaccine available, along with independent health systems that were kind of part of that first phase. We've got federally qualified healthcare centers across the state who have vaccine available, as well as the Indian Health Service and the Veterans Administration. So, you know, there are more ways to become vaccinated than ever. And so that's a great change. Now, relative to the allocation, for the state allocation, so that's what we get here at the state level, and we get out to the partners that we're working with directly. Last week was the first week where they didn't have appointments totally full. And so, you know, we're watching that very closely. What we're seeing now is more opportunity for just, you know, not even needing to make an appointment with those vaccinators. You can just go to, you know, some open clinic hours. So it makes it even easier. Just walk right in and get vaccinated. And so we'll continue to, you know, make vaccines as easy as possible for people to get so that, again, people can make the right choice and make the easy choice to become vaccinated.
We're always concerned because of the way this vaccine is stored that some of it would be wasted when people are in need. Are we losing any doses because of that?
Yeah, not, the state not level. Far. Yeah. You know, we do see, you know, a very minimal amount of wastage for, you know, just things like, you know, a needle couldn't pull out that last dose, or, you know, we had an unexpected, you know, no show at the very end of the day and a dose was wasted here or there. So, you know, we do see isolated situations where that happens, but nothing, no wastage yet because, you know, we've had expiration, you know, dates come up on us with any of the available vaccine. And we're still ordering 100% of what's available to us at the state level.
As South Dakota remains open for business and other states have their vaccine rollouts at different paces, what's your advice to people who are having events or running a business in South Dakota, especially in the service industry, as we get, you know, gear up for visitor season? We don't want to be that state who is in the news for, you know, having an event that spreads a disease to another state. Talk in our last remaining minute about what your recommendation would be as people and business owners think about their own mitigation efforts and the choices that they're making in their personal lives and at work.
Well, I mean, you know, again, we know what we can do to stop or slow the spread of COVID. We can, you know, continue to wash our hands, stay away from other people, or at least at a distance, stay out of large groups at this point, wear masks if you are coming into contact with folks that you don't know their vaccination status of. But now we have the tool of vaccination. And so to business owners, I would say, you know, let's help get your employees vaccinated. It's really something that you can do for their health, for the good of your organization and keep them healthy. And people do need to make those determinations about the activities that they're engaged in. You know, we saw a recent event, you know, happen in South Dakota. It was, you know, folks from Minnesota came to South Dakota to be a part of an event. And there had been, you know, there was widespread COVID transmission from the communities that these folks came from. So they were in, you know, in a state of community transmission. They came together and then they went home and there was more community transmission. And, you know, that's not something that should be surprising because we know that's how COVID spreads. So, you know, I think people just need to continue to use the knowledge that they have, make good decisions for themselves. And now they have a great decision to make about vaccination. We know it's safe. And we know it's effective, and we know it's our way out of this pandemic.
Secretary Kim Malsom-Risden, South Dakota's Department of Health Secretary, thanks so much for being here with us again and really digging down into what variants are and how the vaccine rollout is going. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Lori. Take care.
On this day in 1993, Governor George S. Mickelson and seven others were killed in a plane crash in eastern Iowa. Mickelson was accompanied by Chief Pilot Ron Becker, State Pilot Dave Hansen, Economic Development Commissioner Roland Dolly, Energy Policy Commissioner Ron Reed, Northern State Power Manager Angus Anson, First Bank CEO David Berkland, and Sioux Development Foundation President Ron Hangey. The group was aboard a state-owned airplane returning to South Dakota from an economic development trip to Ohio. A propeller assembly failed during poor weather, leading to the crash. The legacy of Governor Mickelson is recognized in multiple memorials, from schools, scholarships, and the George S. Mickelson Trail in the Black Hills, to reconciliation efforts with Native tribes in the state. All eight are memorialized by the Fighting Stallions statue on the Capitol grounds and pier. The bronze is an enlarged version of a 1935 mahogany carving by sculptor Korzhov Jolkovsky. Fighting Stallions symbolically represent South Dakota's struggle to overcome adversity, a desire for achievement, and the courage to believe in the future. It is a tribute to all of those who have made the ultimate sacrifice. That crash was overshadowed in national news coverage because it happened on the same day as the end of the Branch Davidian siege near Waco, Texas. Governor Mickelson, seven others on an economic development delegation lost in a plane crash on this day, 28 years ago. Production assistance for This Day in South Dakota History comes from Dr. Brad Tennant, history professor at Presentation College in Aberdeen.
I'm Tanya Mosley.
Beginning in preschool, Black girls are most likely to be suspended. Preschool. This is not an inequity. This is a crisis.
Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley joins us to talk about legislation she's sponsoring that aims to end the disproportionate punishment of Black girls in school. That's next time on Here and Now.
Monday at 1 Central, noon Mountain on SDPB.
South Dakota's finest high school band students gather at the Mitchell High School Performing Arts Center for the South Dakota All-State Band Concert. SDPB brings you the sights and sounds. Friday, April 23rd at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB.
Hey, it's Rachel Martin. There are certain things you can always count on. The sun rises and sets, the clocks change come springtime, the weekend never feels quite long enough. Like clockwork, you can rely on Morning Edition from NPR News to bring you trustworthy journalism and keep you connected with your community. Listen every weekday.
Join us weekdays at 5 a.m. Central and weekends at 7 a.m. Central on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, there's a brand new exhibit at the South Dakota Air and Space Museum. It honors one of the state's World War II veterans. Maurice Maury Crowe was a turret gunner in a B-17 bomber. And he's now the recipient of one of the nation's highest military decorations, the Distinguished Flying Cross. SDPB's David Ossity Scott has more.
A newsreel brings the rumble of prop engines, the crack of anti-aircraft fire, and explosions from German flak cannons to life. But it's all something Maury Crowe lived. He's part of a revered yet shrinking generation of World War II veterans. Friends, family, and loved ones gathered recently to celebrate Crowe's 101st birthday. He was inducted into the Distinguished Flying Cross Society as part of the celebrations. As he watches old film footage of his unit in action, the veteran speaks with a humility that has become almost trademark for his generation.
We all had a job, and job to do, and actually, when you get in combat, you had to do a job for yourself, or you wouldn't get back.
Crowe served as a tech sergeant in the 8th Air Force. In training, he was told that only 6 or 7 out of a crew of 13 could expect to make it back.
I'm very lucky, you know, basically. My best friend had to be in a different airplane than mine because we were the same rank. And he was shot out of the ball turret over the North Sea.
Crowe survived 25 bombing missions over Germany and says there were close calls.
We were hit and had lost two engines, and it never touched the co-pilot, the blast, in his seat, and never damaged at all. It blew me out where I was in a circle of my ammunition cans, and then hung them. When I got back to normal, I was hanging there by my neck.
His stories, and thousands like them, are what organizations across the country hope to preserve. The Air and Space Museum and Ellsworth Air Force Base have a special connection to this history. The base trained B-17 crews for service during the war. Colonel David Doss is the current commander of the 28th Bomb Wing at Ellsworth. He says the stories of those who've served have important relevance today.
Our airmen today, and really for every generation preceding World War II, stands on the shoulders of the giants that is Maury Crew, and the many thousands and thousands and thousands of people just like him.
Doss says while technology and equipment changes, air men and women serve today for many of the same reasons Maury Crow did. Doss sees keeping that connection of service as vital to future generations. John Mollison is the communications director for the Air and Space Museum. He says the mission to preserve these stories is urgent. He compares the loss of a member of the greatest generation to the burning of a library.
When these veterans pass, if their stories aren't checked out, they go up in smoke. And it truly is not only an honor, but it's a duty for all of us to make sure that when we meet our elders who've been a part of important moments and important times, that we download it, that we listen to them, that we learn from them, and apply them to the future.
Mollison says that sense of humility and duty can make it hard to catalog veterans' experiences, because many aren't looking for fame. Often, it's the veterans' loved ones who help preserve their legacy. Kamala Brennick says Maury Crow is a longtime family friend. She sees him as a surrogate grandfather. Brennick says he would rarely talk about his time in the war.
I remember finding a part of the parachute, maybe some pictures, and he would never talk about it. He just said, yes, I was in the war. I think a lot of it was guilt that he made it home and his crew didn't. I remember people would say, oh, you are a hero. And he would say, no, I'm not the hero. The ones that died over there are the true heroes.
But over time, Crow opened up about his service. After Brennick found an old scrapbook his mother created, she was determined to preserve those memories.
Finally, then Maury would sit down and we did start talking through it. And he would explain the pictures and the articles. We found he thought he had lost his Purple Heart and his Distinguished Flying Cross medal. And we found them in the bottom of a drawer one time. And he said, I will never be without these again. So I made a shadow box, and that shadow box sits in his apartment.
Brennick sees Crow's experiences as a window into a different time and way of viewing the world. She says there was a sense of determination and personal duty that many today may not understand.
I have kids that are in their mid-20s, and like my son says, Mom, I don't think I could have done what Maury did. And it's like, you're right. We just, the sacrifices that they made for us are so important. And I think we take it for granted. We live in such a different world, not a bad world, but just such a different world.
Brennick says after learning about his military service and experiences in combat, her family has a whole new picture of their longtime friend. She says these days they appreciate spending time together when they can. Maury Crow finds pleasure in the simple things, like a cold drink on the porch or a game of cards with friends. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm David Azadi Scott in Rapid City.